By defining or creating a private sphere, a place where the individual is relatively free, what happens is that the borders of the state and the borders of the public eye are bounded. By creating a private sphere, you effectively create this space of freedom. I think many social problems in society today, people tend to blame on new technology. I just don't think technology is that deterministic. There's no way you could defend privacy if you don't also defend the kind of right of people to close the door as and when they choose and see fit.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Tiffany Jenkins. Tiffany, welcome to the show.
A pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you on. Your first time on, hopefully not your last. And we need to talk about your new book, Strangers and Intimates, The Rise and Fall of Private Life. I have to say, and I'm not just saying this to blow smoke, this book is superb. It really is an excellent deep historical dive into the ideas behind private life and public life, the relationship between the two. It is a fascinating read. I've got a million questions to ask you about it, and I'll try and squeeze in as many as I can in this podcast. But I guess let's kick off with what stirred you to write the book. As I say, there's loads of history in it, and I've got some questions on that for you. But I guess what really triggered you was the kind of contemporary contradictions on private life, where on the one hand, people often demand privacy these days, but at the same time, we're expected to live as publicly as possible, to show everything in the public realm, to put ourselves constantly online. Was it those kinds of trends that made you think you needed to really have a look at these ideas and what they mean?
Very much so. So we live in a, I mean, I begin the book with Harry and Meghan, who are constantly showing their lives, their private lives, in public on Netflix or whatever. But at the same time, as they would call for restrictions in terms of the way the press could report them, a completely controlling kind of attitude. So that was one contradiction, the kind of the openness and authentic private self in public whilst calling for privacy. But the other was the way in which there's often calls for privacy laws and a big discussion around tech invading our privacy. But at the same time, the private realm is seen almost as toxic, as this place of bullying and abuse. And I just thought there's no way you could defend privacy if you don't also defend the kind of right of people to close the door as and when they choose and see fit.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm very interested in the difference between privacy and private life and what those two things mean. One thing that people think these days, and you've just mentioned there the technological element to it, there is this presumption that everything was hunky-dory until tech came along, and all of a sudden you've got kids being tempted onto TikTok and Instagram to reveal everything about their lives, to put up intimate photographs, to tell everyone how they're feeling. There is this presumption that technology is the cause of some of these problems of privacy that you're talking about. But you see it as being longer term than that. Technology plays a role, but it's not the key determining factor of some of these problems.
I think many social problems in society today, people tend to blame on new technology. So the rise in mental health conditions, for example, the difficulty people have with reading books and paying attention, and privacy and the tendency to put our private lives out online is also blamed on tech. And I just don't think technology is that deterministic. It arises in a particular time, in a particular place, and it is as shaped by that sort of historical moment as it shapes. And if you go back in history, and particularly in the 20th century, there are numerous occasions when the private realm is breached. There's either intrusions into it with a kind of new and a kind of early behaviorism of the 20th century, but also a number of movements towards the kind of putting the private self out in public. So, for example, you know, reality TV begins before Mark Zuckerberg is a twinkle in his mother's eye in the 1970s. There's two programs I talk about, an American one and a British one, where families are put on television as if they would be in a reality TV program today. And that happens voluntarily. You know, they do that. They want to be much more authentic. Real life isn't like the films, says Margaret Wilkins in the British version. Obviously, you also had Candid Camera in the 50s in America, where people's lives are being filmed. So that was a different technology. But what it kind of reveals is that the willingness to put your intimate life out in public happened before new technology?
One of the things that really struck me when I was reading the book is that I think a lot of people will have the presumption that there was always a private life, that people in earlier times may have been much poorer than us, their lives may have been shorter and more brutish, but everyone had a home to go to, everyone could close the door, everyone could kind of do what they wanted in their own realm. It seemed the idea of having that private life, having a space of your own or a room of one's own, it seems like a timeless idea. It seems like something that must have been around forever and ever. But your book really teases out the shifts and changes in that thinking and the way that idea develops over time and becomes more distinctive over time. Give us a little sense of that question of the timelessness of private life, why people think that and why that might not actually be right.
I think there's a tendency today to see everything as a continuation of the past. So one thing I really wanted to do in this book was show how things have been very different and try and pick out why in different periods. And if you go back to the 17th century, privacy was seen as frightening. You know, being on your own, the devil might come to you. The sense that you would do something differently in private than public was a kind of a scary thing. There was a instruction that really struck me in the sort of in my reading for this book, which was a man called Richard Braithwaite, who wrote a social conduct book, and he says, "Do nothing privately that you wouldn't do publicly." There was little distinction really between public and private, and that comes not because of prosperity or property or the development of the home. You know, if the person who was wealthy in a castle would have no privacy, as you know, like the person in the shack who was poor. So there was minimal distinction, and it happens accidentally. I don't even think people set out wanting a private space or privacy, but it happens really as a result of A, the Protestant Reformation, but also then the flip-flopping, particularly in England, over religious faith between Protestant, more Protestant, Catholic, a kind of moderate Protestant. And in that period, you get this development of people thinking privately, differently to the kind of the authority of the day and to what is being mandated. So it's a kind of accidental split, which then results in this idea of toleration in 1680 or so, the sense that to deal with all the religious diversity, because it had been tremendously tumultuous and blood, you know, Europe was blood-soaked because of the kind of fights over following a particular faith. To reconcile that and to deal with it, religion was confined relatively to a private sphere. And then all hell breaks loose. It's absolutely fascinating. So people in the 17th century talking about their freedom of conscience in the religious sphere, and then suddenly they're talking about it in terms of intimate relations in the 18th century, and you have what is effectively the first sexual revolution.
That is such an important point that you make now and that you make in the book, which is that the idea of private life is not something that people just sat down and came up with, but it springs from so many different intellectual, revolutionary, political trends over a long period of time. And you trace those in excellent detail in the book. And I wanted to ask you about a few of them. You mentioned there the Protestant Reformation. There's a great chapter on the rise of Protestantism and Luther and the role that that plays in developing this idea. You talk about the spark of conscience, and you have this really interesting word, a word I love, which is interiority. And you talk about how Luther's ideas, which is that you didn't need all the paraphernalia of the church to communicate with God, but rather you should look at the scriptures yourself, think for yourself, talk to God through your own mind, through your own speech. How that gave rise to an idea of interiority, which then contributed to some of these developments you're talking about. Can you explain what you mean by that idea?
I think Luther comes along and he's not against authority per se, but he does destabilize the authority of the Catholic Church. And as you say, create a situation where the believer, there was more kind of focus on the believer interpreting the scripture for themselves, getting rid of those sort of authorities. The believer would do this both by listening, a lot of his sermons were spoken, but also by reading. The Bible and the texts and his texts were translated from the Latin into English and German. So you have, I think, this sense in which the individual is reading for themselves and thinking for themselves, and they're having this direct relationship with God. So I think they become much more, the noise of the outside goes. And if you read the sort of early Puritan diaries in particular, this is sort of early 17th century, they all talk about praying privately. And they don't mean private in the sense that we would. They're not always on their own. They might be with their family, with the household, with a chaplain. But there's this sense in which you have a private relationship with God. And I think that develops a kind of an inner life and also a primacy on the individual working it out for themselves.
Hi, it's Brendan here. I want to let you know that Spiked has a really exciting event coming up. On Wednesday, the 28th of May, the wonderful Andrew Doyle will be sitting down with Spiked's editor, Tom Slater, to talk about his new book, The End of Woke. The event will be taking place in person in Westminster. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. and the discussion will start at 7 p.m. You'll get a complimentary drink and even get the chance to put your own questions to Andrew. And afterwards, you can stay for more drinks and get Andrew to sign your book. Tickets are available exclusively to Spike supporters, members of our online donor community, for just £20. If you're already a supporter, you'll be able to go to the online hub right now to buy your ticket. If you're not already a Spike supporter, now is the perfect time to become one. For as little as £5 a month or £50 a year, you can get access to this event plus so many other perks, including reading the site ad-free and leaving comments under articles. To find out more about this event, go to spiked-online.com/events. And to become a Spike supporter, go to spiked-online.com/supporters. That's spiked-online.com/supporters to become a Spike supporter today. We hope to see you there. You make the point, and I think it's an important one, that you're not arguing that Luther or the Protestant Reformation was in favour of private life. And in fact, Luther often argued against it. He was quite wary of hermits. He thought they were a bit dirty and a bit weird. He had that line, which you quote, where he says, "By all means, flee solitude, for the devil watches and lies in wait for you when you are alone." So it's not as if the Protestants said, yay, we're coming along and we're going to give people a private life. But there is a relationship, isn't there, between that revolutionary idea that you should interpret the scriptures for yourself, and I guess almost the inevitable development, although there are many other contributing factors over time, of the idea that individual life is important. So how do you see the relationship between Protestant Reformation and what was to come later in terms of the idea of private sanctity?
Well, yes. I mean, the Protestants would later intervene further into the private lives of people in England, particularly in their intimate relations. So they were definitely not pro private life. And as you say, Luther sort of said, don't be on your own because the devil is going to come to you. I think what it did, though, accidentally, the Protestant Reformation was authorize the individual. If you chart the development of private life, two things happen. One is there are changing ideas of the role of authority, where authority comes from, and how much power they have in your life, how much they can intervene. This might be the king or the pope or later the state. And the other is the idea of the self, what the self is. Does it need to constantly be overseen? Can it decide for itself? Is the self a thinking thing, which is what I think, I can't remember exactly Hobbes's word, Locke's words about the self, but it's a sense in which the self can decide. And that's the basis for private life, which is that effectively people can choose how to run particular parts of their own life. Now, Luther sets that in motion accidentally, but I do think the flip-flopping in England is really important. So Henry VIII comes along and sets in the English Reformation for his own purposes, effectively. And then I also talk not just about Luther, but Thomas More, who resists Henry's demands that every subject in England take two oaths. One is the oath of succession, and that's the one that he refuses to take. And in the end, he's executed for it. So he won't publicly say that he backs the king and effectively sees him as more important than the pope. That then creates a kind of dissident Catholicism. So you had these networks in England and Europe of Catholics secretly deciding how to worship for themselves. They're also sort of making that decision. So you have that division between what people are saying publicly and what they are saying privately. And both Protestants and Catholics and various other kind of religions in between them, as they fragment, start talking about how do we have liberty of conscience. And they're tentative at first because it's for their own purposes. They don't want to give it to other people because they think their faith is the right way to find salvation. And in the end, they begin to think, well, actually, it's got to come from us. And everyone within certain parameters, this is a relative and incremental process, should have freedom of conscience.
Yeah, I think your commentary in the book on the flip-flopping, particularly in the context of England, is fascinating. And you're not only the rise of this Lutheran idea of interiority or the individual capacity, but also the impact that has on Catholic worshippers and what it compels them to do in terms of in their private lives is incredibly well drawn out in the book. So you mentioned their liberty of conscience, which then gets forced to the forefront in as a consequence of these religious tumult, religious wars, religious conflict. And I want to ask you about how that develops then further during the more enlightened period when Enlightenment thought takes off. And you mentioned John Locke, of course, and his letter on toleration. You contrast Locke to Hobbes, and you make the point that Locke, in his argument for freedom of conscience or toleration, he really drew on the kind of rationality of the human mind, the idea that the individual is capable of thinking for himself and deciding for himself. How important was the rise of that Enlightenment idea in contributing to this further delineation between public life and private life?
I think what you get in the 18th century is a number of developments from Enlightenment thought that really impact upon the society, in as much as it was a very religious society, and it was still very religious. But you have people like David Hume talking about the way in which God intervened less on a day-to-day basis. And people start talking about their own individual conscience in terms of other areas of life which aren't just about how they worship. They talk about lust and intimate relations as natural. And this is a huge shift. I think in sort of 1640 or so, there's a woman called Susan Doughty who is hung for the crime of adultery. The Protestants intervened in intimate life to the extent that neighbors were instructed to report on neighbors, and you could peer through peepholes. And suddenly, in the 18th century, people start talking about the way in which, because these sentiments are natural, these feelings are natural, and also because I have freedom of conscience, I can choose who I spend my intimate time with. And that's a dramatic shift. I think it's also a sort of reinforced by the voyages of discovery. Basically, ideas about what is and isn't natural start feeding into it. And they don't replace the kind of the religious thinking, but they certainly temper it and change it.
You have this important point that kind of runs through the book and certainly runs through the historical analysis that you put forward, which is that private life rises in tandem with public life. And there is an interdependency you describe between the two. So it's not as if there was always a flourishing public life which superseded any sense of a private life, but that actually both come to the fore around the same time in different ways, relate to each other, interconnect. Talk a little bit about what you mean by that, particularly as it pertains to the 18th century and the rise of, I guess, a clearer sense of what it means to exist as a public person, and then how that impacts on the valuation of private life.
This is one of the more difficult points to make. I don't think everybody really picks up on. But I think the way to think about it is that by defining or creating a private sphere, a place where the individual is relatively free, what happens is that the borders of the state and the borders of the public eye are bounded. You effectively, by creating a private sphere, you effectively create this space of freedom. That then extends in the 18th century. There's this growth of a sort of non-state area, the growth of the press. You know, the accidental lapse of the licensing law means that there's this sort of newspapers just pop up absolutely everywhere, first in London and then across the country. And the newspapers are sort of subjecting government to scrutiny. There's the growth of the embryonic political parties. There's huge debates happening in public, in the coffee houses, which effectively develop a kind of, they effectively develop the sort of space for criticism, whether it's for theatre or for poetry. I mean, there's such a lively, lively atmosphere. And for the first time, people start talking about public opinion. I think there's a sense that you have a kind of a rising mercantile class, rising bourgeoisie with the sort of development of capitalism, and they're all playing something of a public role, which they are too constituted. They're private men thinking about how to maybe hold the state and the government to account. And they're also thinking about how to behave in public, how to behave with strangers. So there's a big discussion about politeness, which is a new concept. It comes from the French polir, to polish. And that kind of, I mean, this is also partly after all the religious wars. So you do want to be slightly careful about who you're talking to, given everything that's happened. But also, they might be merchants from abroad, from the Spice Islands or something. So people start thinking about how do we interact with all these new people, whether they're people of new wealth or traders. The handshake develops, and there's a real sense of the kind of positivity of this kind of interaction. It's seen as a kind of entirely positive thing that you kind of rub off the harsh edges of each other. It's also a time of sort of the assembly rooms and balls and libraries, and there's just an utter flourishing of public life, both in physical form and as an idea. And then at the same time, you've got something similar happening with the private realm. There are spaces that are being hammered out in homes that have particular functions now. People are reading magazines like The Spectator, which is all about spectating in society, but they're reading that in the privacy of the home. The corridor is slowly invented, and back passages. So that is a kind of a physical thing. But you also have, with the birth of the novel, whether it's Daniel Defoe's Robinson Crusoe or Pamela by Samuel Richardson, you also have a kind of imprinting in public of the values of the private realm, whether it's romance and intimacy or emotions. They're there all on the page, and that kind of gives it a kind of validation and value. And then, of course, the household is being separated from work. So it becomes this relatively secluded, although it's not cut off from society, it's still a very kind of, it's quite a sociable space. But it becomes this kind of space of intimacy and relative seclusion. And that happens at exactly at the same time. I think if, and I talk about an academic called John Brewer, who's done a sort of study of how people are using the words private and public. And he argues, in terms of the books that are being written in this period, he argues that there is a new, these two ideas of public and private are given form and definition in this period. And it is effectively what Adam Ferguson calls an age of separations. So what initially sort of overlapping circles, if you like, between public and private becomes much more defined and explicit. It is a great age of separations.
Hi, it's Brendan here. I just wanted to remind you that you can still buy my latest book. It's called After the Pogrom, 7th of October, Israel and the Crisis of Civilization, and it's available right now from Amazon. I'm really proud of this book. It is an unflinching account of how the West failed the moral test of 7th of October 2023, which of course is the day that Hamas and other militants invaded Israel and unleashed barbarism. The book documents in pretty chilling detail how activists, academics, and others in the West ended up making excuses for Hamas's violence, ended up taking the side of the pogromists against the pogrom's victims, and ended up in the process turning their backs on the values of civilization. The book is fundamentally a call to arms for Western civilization. It makes the case for restoring Enlightenment values and standing with Israel while it's under attack by radical Islamists. I don't know if an author is allowed to describe his own book as essential reading, but I really do think it's essential reading. It's called After the Pogrom, 7th of October, Israel and the Crisis of Civilization, and you can get your copy right now from Amazon. Yeah, that chapter, which I think is called Age of Separations, is really, really enlightening. I learnt a lot in there. And I think, you know, there is this tendency, you've just mentioned there, that the private realm becomes a site of seclusion. It's separate from work. It's a place where you go in order to, the way I've understood it anyway, is that one of the most valuable things about the private realm is that it is a place of refuge from the vagaries of everyday life, the pressures of everyday life. You can close the door, you can take your shoes off, you can, you know, speak in a way you might not normally speak, you can rant, you can let off steam, all these points that you make. So there is a tendency, I think of these two realms as being in conflict, you know, or one being a hiding place from the other, which suggests a kind of conflict or a kind of tension. And that can be true. But one of the points you make in your book about the separation of these two realms is that both are important to the other. And the way I've always understood it is that the private realm is in some ways the place in which you kind of refortify yourself in order to be a better public person or in order to behave better in the public realm. And in that part of the book, you do talk a bit about John Stuart Mill and his book on liberty, in which I've always thought that one of the most important points he makes is that people who are more self-reliant and self-confident as a consequence of being free are likely to be better behaved, more conscientious people publicly in the world around them. So the private realm and the public realm are kind of dependent on each other, aren't they, for the health of one another?
Very much so. Hannah Arendt once put it, a life spent entirely in public in the presence of others becomes, as we would say, shallow. And I think we all know what she means, really. So if you're in public too much, it's almost like you're sunburnt. You know, you've got nothing to draw upon. And you do need to be able to retreat, to let off steam, to really release the tensions of ordinary life and kind of sometimes transgress, because there are different rules in private than there are in public, and we can be bad people in private. And I think that allows a kind of a release to then go back out into public. I think it also protects the public from the private. So not only are we better subjects in public if we've got a private realm to go back to, but also the public realm is a place not of kind of the private. It's not, you know, at the moment you've got sort of intimacy invading the public realm. It's very difficult to conduct kind of political discussion because everything's become so personalized. Equally, kind of criticism, I think, the idea that you might be a public person engaging in something common where you have different rules to the private is something that I think has been lost. But it is a definite benefit of the two, public and private. It's almost like a dance. You need the both partners, really, for it to work.
Yeah, I think everyone knows that feeling when you've had a long day in the public realm. And it doesn't need to involve physical labor. It can just be meetings, talking to people, having to put on one's happy, nice face. You know, that can be exhausting.
It can be. And it's sometimes people describe it as inauthentic. But I don't think it is. It can also be, I don't know, if you're ever in a relationship with somebody and you do see their worst as well as their best selves at home. But then you go and see them be their professional self or their kind of public self. And you remember, actually, no, this person is witty. This person is clever. This person doesn't just wear pajamas and eat porridge. You know, they can be refined. And I think the two, you know, it is also sometimes our best self, our public self.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I wanted to ask you about the idea of privacy. It's always been a word I've been slightly wary of, especially in more recent times, because it does often seem to come, it seems to be most often used as a means of clamping down on certain forms of freedom of expression. So you will often see the idea of privacy wielded against press freedom, for example, and the paparazzi and people who take photographs of people in a slightly public place, but not necessarily a public place. You know, the right to privacy can sometimes feel like a censorious idea in the 21st century, but you talk about the rise of, well, the right to privacy as written about by Samuel D. Warren and Louis D. Brandeis in 1890 in the Harvard Law Review, when they set out what a right to privacy might mean, what it might look like. What do you think that kind of attempt to codify privacy in the late 1800s, early 1900s, what did that tell us about what was happening to private life? And is there a problem when you try to codify this stuff too much?
Okay, so I think what you had in the 19th century is a number of things. There are new technologies. There's instantaneous cameras, which can be, we know, which are portable, and meant that people no longer went to the shop to have their photograph taken. It's also the growth of a kind of urban society and yellow journalism. This is quite, you know, scandalous types of journalism. And I think there's a sense then, which is, I actually think it's a sort of, it's seen as vulgar, really, what's happening. And the right to privacy article was an attempt to kind of restrict the press, really. To the extent that they argued that for ordinary people, they should be able to define really effectively what is written about them, regardless of whether it was true or not. Now, that didn't go through, but there is this tension. It's a real tension between people's desire for privacy, particular public figures, and the rights of the press. And Brandeis later wrote that actually he thought his article was wrong, that I think he put it like sunlight is the best disinfectant, that when it comes to a democracy, freedom of expression should trump privacy. And I think that's probably right. He's a very interesting figure in the way that he changes his mind on that. I also think in the context of America, there is always this tendency to turn to the Constitution or to turn to law to regulate parts of society that Americans find inconvenient or makes them uncomfortable. I think that's sometimes a good thing when it's something like freedom of expression, but it's limited. I mean, the law, it's a bit like the discussions around regulating the internet today. You know, the law can only do so much. It can sort of set standards and make people accountable and punish them for the things that they've done wrong. But as a message, as shaping society, I think it's, you know, at best fruitless, pretty limited, and doesn't really grapple with the dynamics.
I think that's right, yeah. Let's talk a bit about some of the more recent developments in the 20th century right up to today. I want to ask you about a couple of things. I mean, the personal is political, that famous slogan, the meaning of that, the impact of that, not just the slogan itself, but what it represented and what it did to society, or what it told us about what was happening in society. And as you mentioned earlier, there is this growing wariness of the private realm. So there's this insistence on privacy in many situations, you know, leave me alone, stop taking my picture, stop intruding on Harry and Meghan's dinner or whatever else it might be. At the same time as there is this palpable suspicion of the private realm as a site of abuse, as a site of, you know, children being led astray or women being mistreated. How do you explain those recent contradictions where on the one hand there is this valuation of privacy and often legalization of privacy, but at the same time this growing suspicion of the private realm itself?
Let's take the personal as political first. So I look at the development in the sort of 50s and 60s and then into the early 70s of what happens in the new left, which is, I think they sort of become disenchanted really with the public realm. And this relates to the sort of the relationship between public and private. They become disenchanted with sort of various failures really in the social movements and start turning towards the realization of the authentic self. If you read some of the students for Democratic Society stuff, they're very much talking about sort of authenticity and realizing the self as a political movement. There's a big split in feminism between the kind of liberal feminists of Betty Friedan and the radical feminists, people like Carol Hanisch, who is the one who writes that personal is political article. And I think what that does, and you can sort of see, they sort of become disenchanted too with changes in public life, whether it's, equal pay or childcare while you're working, and start thinking that actually the private realm is the site of the patriarchy and the inequality of women, and we need to go into language or child rearing and education. That disorganizes public and private. It sort of opens up the private realm to intervention, but it also gives up to a large degree on the public realm as a place to achieve freedom and equality. And it basically effectively dissolves the private realm. That also contributes to your second question about the way in which you have this sort of the ascendancy of discussions about privacy, but at the same time as the private realm is demonized. And I chart, this is quite an abstract thing, so I chart it through a Royal Commission report called the Younger Report in 1973. And this happens in Britain, and there's a sense in which we need privacy laws. This is quite new for Britain because, unlike America, they're not quite as legalistic. And there was always this assumption that actually Brits had a stiff upper lip and you didn't intrude into other people's business. There was a sort of Victorian expression of the right to be let alone and the right to mind your own business that was really sort of still hanging in the air in the late 60s, early 70s. But in this report, something kind of bifurcates in the definition of privacy. So the Victorian idea of the right to be let alone is how they were originally talking about it in the report. We need to be left alone, is how a Labour MP called Alex Lyon puts it in debates in Parliament. But at the same time, there is this beginning discussion of the discussion of what you see today, which is around sort of surveillance and wiretapping. And the definition of privacy bifurcates. It's no longer, or rather, there's a Victorian idea of being right to be let alone, and the second idea, which is the one that we've got today, which is really the right to control information about yourself, which means it could be also the right to control information about yourself in public. It's very much the sort of way in which Meghan and Harry sort of talk about it. Now, what I found sort of reading this report was that towards the end, she privacy begins to get quite a bad rep. It's seen as dangerous, and the private realm is seen too as perhaps as a place that needs to be opened up, because it too is, in the words of Edmund Leach in the Reith lectures in the 1970, sort of 1973, the source of all our discontents. So what you really have is, for some time, particularly from the Victorian age, you've got the idea of privacy connected to the private realm. This is, the kind of the space of the home, and a kind of a space where the individual is free. But towards the end of the sort of 70s, it splits from the private realm. So I know that sounds slightly confusing, but effectively the private realm is opened up, and privacy becomes this very small, narrow thing that we see today. All discussions about privacy usually are nothing to do today with the private realm. There's no defense of the private realm when people talk about privacy. It's just sort of controlling information about themselves.
Yeah, no, that is that point that you make, and you make in the book, really helped to clarify my thinking on this question, because it's so striking, and I'm sure many listeners will be struck too by the fact that we live in a world in which privacy is talked about a lot and often celebrated, but at exactly the same time as the private realm is being undermined. And I think you've laid out why that contradiction exists very well. There is this, alongside all this stuff and feeding into it, there is this growing culture of suspicion of people who want a private life. And it's really summed up in the slogan, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. But I've got loads of stuff I want to hide from everyone. We all behave oddly at home sometimes. We rant and rave. We speak to ourselves when there's no one else in the house. People do strange things at home, and they might have, peculiar pursuits. They might read things that you're not supposed to read. Who knows what people do? It's their own business. But what do you think that suspicion, this suspicion of people who want a private realm, a strictly private realm that is separate from the world and is for them and their loved ones alone. What underpins that suspicion? If the idea of the private life and the public life both grow out of, you know, the spark of conscience and the growth of enlightenment thought and the evaluation of conscience and so on, does the undermining of private life and the corresponding undermining of public life, does that spring from a turn against all those progressive modern ideas? Is that what we're really seeing here?
Okay, well, I think firstly, it's not just that we do embarrassing things at home, which we all do. I mean, you know, I don't want people to see all sorts of things about me in private. But it's also that there's certain things that are sort of unworldly and don't really work if they're subjected to public scrutiny. I mean, there are lots of things that do require being subjected to public scrutiny. But things like birth and giving birth or love or even death, you know, these are kind of so unruly, almost irrational things that need the space to kind of be themselves, if you like, without that kind of scrutiny. So it's not just that we do bad things. It's also there's parts of life which just don't really welcome that type of attention. And I think it corrupts them if we are looking at these areas of life through the eyes of strangers rather than intimates. As for why, I think there's a couple of things. I was really struck by a couple that I talked to called Joe Gao and Carmen Wilson, who are academics in the States, who filmed themselves having sex and put it on OnlyFans and then Pornhub. And I spoke to them and they said, but we love each other. We're not doing anything wrong. Why has there been this huge controversy? And I just thought there's a very odd thing that they seem to get no validation from doing that in private. And they need the kind of the eyes of strangers upon them as if they have a minimal sense of themselves. You know, Christopher Lash put it as a kind of a minimal self that is so weak and needy. It constantly needs this sort of affirmation that it exists. So I think that there's something about that that explains a sort of bottom up desire to kind of show everything about your life. This is a narcissistic self, really, but it's a kind of weak self that requires affirmation and recognition. But I think there's two things as well. There's a sense in which that the self that Locke talked about, which is this sort of thinking thing that is able to make decisions about their lives and their society as well. This is the beginnings of sort of, you know, you begin to see sort of ideas about democracy in the sort of 17th century begin. That sort of that robust self that doesn't require living in a glass safe, you know, in a glass case where everybody can see them so they are safe. I think that is certainly weak. And so there's this sense in which we just all need to be protected by having a benevolent kind of overseer. And I think there's also this sense in which the borders of what political life should extend to and the role of authority, it's kind of there isn't a border. And you see it, you do see this in discussions around surveillance, which I don't talk about very much in the book, but there is this kind of, well, we just need to keep everybody safe. And there's a sense in which, you know, the kind of the faceless authority is the one who can do so.
Yeah, it's so true about, you know, the narcissistic self being a representative of the weakened self, the kind of minimal self, I think is incredibly important. There is a tendency these days to explain these trends like OnlyFans or, you know, other forms of public performance, to explain them as too much freedom, too much liberty, when often they speak to a kind of weakened individual rather than the robust, free individuals we might have celebrated in the past.
I mean, just on that, because obviously I talk about the couple who put their sex lives out on the internet, and at the same time as that sort of there's this sort of sex in the sort of pornification really of the public realm, you've also got the intrusion into the private, particularly around students and young people, of things like consent classes or kind of a contractual relationship So I think there's this uncertainty about being in private with somebody else, which means that the kind of authority is welcomed in. It's both kind of invited when you talk to students who are interested in these contracts in their intimate life, and imposed. So that's the really interesting thing about sort of sex now, is that there's no way, the feminists, certainly the liberal feminists of the 60s and 70s would have had the kind of a regulator in their private lives on campus. But this now it is perfectly normal in the States, and to a degree, people are open to it in Britain. And that's got to come from just a kind of a lack of confidence in one's own self, in how one behaves in private with somebody else without being, without being watched.
Absolutely. You mentioned earlier Hannah Arendt, and this is one of the quotes that you opened the book with, where she said in 1958, a life spent entirely in public in the presence of others becomes, as we would say, shallow. Hannah Arendt could not have imagined what would be going on in 2025 because the number of people and the different ways in which people live their lives publicly is extraordinary. You know, you talk about people having sex in public, growing numbers of people do. They put it on OnlyFans or they monetize it on Pornhub or somewhere else. There's also the social media phenomenon, the technological contribution, which, as you say, it might exacerbate some of these trends, but is not necessarily the cause of them. Reality TV has taken off. These are the obvious examples, but there are many ways in which people increasingly live their lives in public. And you talked earlier about the unruly arenas of life, including, well, sex, birth, death, you know, things that are not amenable to being seen by external eyes. But even those things are lived in the public realm. Even death has become, to a certain extent, a performative thing. And celebrities who are dying will often give long interviews and have photographs taken. And we've seen people who are euthanized or given assisted dying. Some of those deaths have been filmed as well and distributed on TV stations. What is the impulse behind that? You talked earlier about people seeming not to get validation from their own lives and instead having to get it from the onlook of strangers. What's going on there? What explains this desire or this longing to do things publicly that we once would have only done privately?
I think I'm really interested in the way in which reality television only films the kind of the private aspect of those people's lives. So it's really striking the way in which, and I think this even happened at 9/11. There was an American reality TV program where they didn't tell the participants what had happened for a short period of time. And then I think they filmed them when they told them finally. But it's striking that effectively it's only the animalistic aspects of life, which you see on reality TV. The idea that they might be people with connections to political movements, to what's happening in Parliament, or what books are being published, or what the plays are being put on. There's a sense in which we are just animals, I think. One of the things is that the kind of the public aspects of us, where we are in communities that go beyond our private lives and our own individual interests, that public sense of ourselves is actually what's lost and why we retreat into the private, if that's a sort of explains part of it. So the sort of our public identities, whether it's I'm not, but I could be a Labour Party supporter, or I could sing in a choir. Those sort of public identities, I think, have lost validation or value. Those forms of recognition and participation have been kind of have eroded, and therefore people retreat into their private lives for meaning. I mean, it's a kind of step away from the world, and therefore require that to be affirmed. So, in a way, the answer, strangely, to protecting private life is to also develop our public selves, I would say. And so they become, our public selves become the kind of object for scrutiny and discussion, not, how we, what we do in bed. I was really struck actually on the kind of the appetite for the private in of two cases. One, when David Bowie died, he chose not to tell people that were outside his intimate circle that he had terminal cancer. And the reaction was just, there was this sort of almost kind of selfish, why didn't you tell me, from his fans. And equally with Kate Middleton, who, didn't tell people that she had a cancer diagnosis for 3 weeks. And the reaction was insane online, particularly. They, there was these wild speculations that she was dead, that, whatever kind of sort of conspiracy theory floated your boat was pushed around by date. And it's almost like her private life is public property.
Yeah, it was extraordinary that, you can't even convalesce privately now without instant suspicion or demands to know why you're not giving more information. I was also struck by David Bowie's death, which felt so unusual in the modern era that a celebrity would just die and there was no awareness beforehand that he was sick. I thought it was an incredibly admirable way to die, if one might put it like that.
It's a burden to have to explain yourself in those situations. People often say, and they've said this about Kate, well, it's raising awareness. It's raising awareness. But I think it's, I don't think it's, I mean, I think it's probably frightening people and burdening her.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, that brings me nicely onto my final question for you, Tiffany, which you kind of have just answered, which is about the restoration of the private realm and I guess correspondingly the public realm. How we go about that? What, I mean, it's such a huge question, and your book makes clear just how large this question is because, as I say, you trace the history of the development of these ideas and then the contributing factors to their corrosion. So there's so much going on. It's bound up with the entire project of humanity in the modern era. So it's not as if we can just pass a law and therefore everything will be fine. It's not as if we can just click our fingers and we'll go back to how things might have been in a more desirable era. But there must be things you think we can do, maybe on a day-to-day basis, maybe as individuals, maybe as communities, that might start to patch up the private realm and as a consequence, restore some of the dynamism and life to the public realm as well. What do you think people can do, apart from read your book, of course?
Yes. I think we could try and take some of the personal out of the political. So in public life, be our best selves, and engage with each other as in a less personal manner, going beyond our own private lives. I mean, certainly politics is very personal at the moment, to the extent that, people go to stand outside Jacob Rees-Mogg's Mogg's house or Brett Kavanaugh's house. I think that's a dangerous illusion. I think we should not criticize people for their private lives to extent. I mean, in as much as a lot of discussion at the moment, whether it's cancelling artists or biographies of, great men and women, is obsessed with their private aspects of their lives. I think we should start thinking about their public achievements and create a a public culture of discussion and debate that is less personal than it has been. I think we should also not criticize people for being phony and inauthentic and put on a kind of go back to the handshake, stop social kissing, that sort of thing. And then there's it sort of that's the sort of the public realm, but the kind of the private realm, it is hard not to use it as currency and the private as currency, because it does sort of humanize you. And we've all got a private realm, so it's a sort of way of connecting to people. But I think not sharing everything, not revealing everything, and shutting the door and maybe going offline is a very, very healthy thing. And developing our own inner life, that does mean reading quietly. thinking, not always needing to be on and recognized, and having a little bit of confidence really in ourselves to be able to do that, to develop our minds. Thank
Tiffany, thank you very much.
you.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe. And in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.